Hey everyone, good evening. It's let's see, November 16th, 2020, and this, as we said last week, this is the 250th class, and it happens to be the 25th class as well, 25th class of this series. Hold on a second. Okay, just a few things before we begin. Remember, I mentioned that Rabbi Sachs said to me I should write for the Wall Street Journal. And I said, well, that's for, you know, it's not my thing. Mayor Soloveitchik, that's his thing to do. And he has written. And this week, if those who get the journal, Friday, well, November 13th, article by Mayor Soloveitchik, What Gentiles Can Learn from Ward Sachs. So I had no idea that that was going to come out, but it's just, it's the very point I made. And especially, I was almost a prophet when I said that Soloveitchik has succeeded Sachs in terms of he followed in his footsteps. And here you go. One of you emailed me, and let me get a picture here for a second. Hold on, where are we? There's a lot of things I want to show you tonight, but we find it. So one of you emailed me that you asked me a question about Eitan Henkin. There's Henkin, unfortunately murdered, and his wife. And I gave this person the information, but I have to point out the name is not Eitan. Now, this name Eitan, by the way, it's mentioned a number of times in Tanakh. Ethan, that's where the name Ethan comes from. It mentions the wise people in the Book of Kings. Comparing Shlomo and Melech, it mentions one of the wise people, Ethan the Ezrachite. And also, Eitan is mentioned other places as well. Furthermore, if you recall, the Talmud understands the word Eitan to refer to Avraham. We even say it in Yom Kippur, don't we? Yiskaranu Avas Eisan. And the Rambam, here, where's the Rambam? I found it here. In, what perek is this? Hold on a second, I'll tell you. Perek, in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, perek Gimel, in describing Avraham's coming to knowledge of God, Kevan Shenigmal Eisan Zeh, after this mighty man was weaned. And that's refers to Avraham. And then the word Eitan also, or Eitan also appears in other places. But Henkin's name is Aleph Yud Tuf Mem, Eitan. So where does that come from? Well, if you look in, I found it here, Tehillim, 19:4, where it says, No, 14, yeah. This is a famous chapter of Tehillim. We all know this one. Hashemai Mesaprim Kvodo Amazed Magid Rakia. At the end, it says, Al Yimshlu Vi. So hold on, let me close up. It says, Al Yimshlu Vi, that they may not have dominion over me, as a son. Then I shall be faultless. That's the translation. If you look in Rashi, Rashi explains what is a sam or itam eyatamim. So faultless. I don't know, maybe David Eisen is with us, could tell us if there's other people in Israel who have the name Eitan. I don't know. He's the only one, and I knew him personally through emails, but he's the only one I've ever come across with the first name. I know that there's some last names, I believe, Effie Eitan, right? But he's the only one I know. So the name is Eitan, not Eitan. And I don't know, like I said, if any other Israelis have that name. Last week, I mentioned, we were talking about Rav David Feinstein, and I mentioned this new book that came out, Yeshiva Days, Learning on the Lower East Side, by Jonathan Bayarin, which is his experience of as a cultural anthropologist of being in learning on MTJ on the Lower East Side. And the publisher writes, an intimate and moving portrait of daily life in New York's oldest institution of traditional rabbinic learning. And I commented that it's not the oldest. Obviously it's not. Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Elchanan goes back to the 19th century. And then I mentioned Torah Vadas. Really, I could have also mentioned Chaim Berlin. Chaim Berlin was established in 1904. And then a few years later, when Rav Chaim Berlin died, he was living in Jerusalem. Before that, he'd been the Rav of Moscow. He was the son of the Netziv. They changed the name. But I also, I said Torah Vadas. Tarvadas, when was Tarvadas founded? Well, interestingly, if hold on, let me stop sharing for a second, show you the big book. If you look in the big book here, incidentally, if you're seeing lots of people's screens, you can change it so you just see the speaker. If that's what, or if you prefer, you can watch everyone. Those who don't know, you go to the upper right-hand corner. So here you have America's Yeshiva, this beautiful book, and it says right here, you can see it, 1919 to 2019. See it there, 1919 to 2019. Tough Reish Ayin Tet, Tough Shin Ayin Tet. However, if you look in the inside of the book, you see it's not 1919. It's actually October of 1918. So it's the Jewish year of Tough Reish Ayin Tet. So I don't know why. Yeah, but it's a falsehood. It's not 1919. In any event, MTJ. So after I said that, I wanted to be 100% sure because these yeshivas often, you know, they have predecessors. The best I could find is online that MTJ is founded in 1907, but it's a Talmud Torah. So that's not a yeshiva, that's a Talmud Torah. I'm not sure when it became a day school and even a high school, because there's Wikipedia gives a date, but I have another source that gives a different date. But I don't think that a Talmud Torah qualifies as a yeshiva. So we still have to say, I think, that Torah Vadas and obviously Chaim Berlin and Yeshivas Ritzo Hanan actually joined together Eitz Chaim, which was the predecessor. That was the earliest one. So, one more thing I want to show you. Oh, two more things. We spoke last week about that very interesting case of someone, he has the donkey milk, and his father has to drink this to save his life, and he won't unless the son drinks it. And I told you about the response, the Rabbi Mel Day from Hong Kong. He cites this, the Pri Eitz Chaim, which is the Torah journal that came out of the yeshiva in Amsterdam, where the Rav says you can't do it. Now, over Shabbos, I looked more carefully. I actually went back to the original response, and we have the Dayan who's listening with us. He also examined it, and he spoke to people in his shul in Brooklyn. And he says everyone disagrees with this, and everyone assumes that you would be able to drink the donkey's milk if that's what you can do to get your father to drink it and save his life. Interestingly enough, the if you look in the original, the Pri Eitz Chaim, everything I told you is correct, but there's one extra point. And what he says would apply in our society, in his opinion, that if the person wouldn't drink the milk, unless you would drink it to show that it's not kosher, you can't drink it. However, he says something else, which is applicable to Amsterdam from 200 years ago, which Rabbi Meir didn't quote. So it's good I went back. He says that if the father refuses to drink the donkey milk, you have to force him. Kofinoson. You force him to drink the donkey milk. So that he says, first you have to try to convince him, but if he doesn't listen, then you force him. Yachrichu kabela trufa. So if you're in a situation where you can't force him, in America you can't force someone, then his position is you can't drink it. But Eli Turco sends me that Rabbi Zilberstein has a number of questions dealing with suicide, and he always assumes that you can't. We don't listen to them. If a wife threatens to commit suicide, if they don't allow an abortion, we don't listen. So this would appear to be a big dispute between the rabbis. And the last thing I want to do before we begin, this takes me back a few weeks. Remember we spoke about the issue of could you invite someone to your house for a Shabbos meal, and or is it leaf neiver, placing a stumbling block? And I mentioned the dispute and Rabbi Moshe Sternbach's position that in opposition to Rabbi Moshe, that since you're trying to do a positive thing, bring the person close to Judaism, there's never an issue of leaf neiver. You can do all these things. What we've seen, it's become apparent to me in recent times, is there's been enormous changes in the Haredi world. What's happened in the Haredi world is that there's a huge, well, maybe huge is not the right word. There's a large population of Haredi young people that are leaving Haredi Judaism, often leaving Orthodoxy completely. It used to be if you had a kid who was non-religious in your house, they would throw him out, literally. One of the Torah in Motion events that took place in Toronto about 10 years ago, I was there speaking. It was one of the big events where they have like four speakers. They have this big thing. And there was a guy there that looked very unusual. For one, he had a tattoo, not the sort of thing usually. So I'm starting speaking to him. He drove all the way up from Rochester. I'm not going to mention his last name, but anyone who knows the yeshiva world will know the name. He's the son of a leading rabbi in Lakewood. And he told me his whole story. And he would listen. He might be listening now. So I'm not mentioning any names. But he was listening to the Torah in Motion's talks, and he wanted to come hear me there. And we spoke, and he told me his whole story. And then he told me that his mother doesn't let him in the house. And I said to him, I was totally frank, I said, well, you know, look, you have a tattoo. And it's not the, but okay, so we had a whole story. Now, fast forward, this is probably more than 10 years. You have a whole population. I want to show you a couple things here. You have a whole population, all over, but in Lakewood also. There's even a, there's a group, an organization, it's like NCSY for these guys, Minyan Shalanu. Just for the off the derech, and when I say off the derech, I mean druggies, all sorts, everything from druggies or just the people who want to wear jeans, all that. It was founded, we spoke about Rabbi Abadi a number of times. This is his son, Rabbi Chaim Abadi. And he runs this organization. It's a wonderful organization, but you can go online and you can see the videos. So let me just give you an example. They take the kids on a trip. You look at the kids, you see these kids are far from Lakewood.
It's not playing. I don't know if you mean to be sharing.
Okay, yes, I'm going to share the sound.
Okay.
Can you hear the sound now?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Just look at these guys. These are all from Lakewood.
Oh, we did the hours. Now what are you doing? You watching Netflix? Come on, bro. Time is food ready. Let's get filled the fish in there.
And if you go to their website, they describe where it came from. Minyan Shalanu was born in response to Lakewood's growing community of disenchanted and troubled teenagers. After dropping out of school, many would deteriorate socially, emotionally, and spiritually, engaging in negative behaviors such as substance abuse, promiscuity and crime, juvenile detention, etc., etc. And you can read all about it. You can go online, watch the videos. There's a picture. You even have a video here of a guy. I couldn't believe that Minyan Shalanu even put it on their website. I don't think NCSY would put something like this on their website. He does a rap song explaining how it began.
Minyan Shalanu in the house. Put your hands up, ladies and gentlemen. Minyan Shalanu, the only place you
want to be. Okay, so obviously it's things are changing in the Haredi world. So now there's a new phenomenon. I'm going to show you some things now. I'm glad you're sitting down because you're going to find this, I think, astounding. What they are now saying, the leadership in the Haredi world, and it goes back to this idea. Well, let me first show it to you, and then I'll explain you why it's relevant to the halachic principle we spoke about. Well, first an example, here is Rabbi Gershon Edelstein. Rabbi Gershon Edelstein is, together with Chaim Kanievsky, he's the head of Ponevezh, and he's the leader of the mainstream Lithuanian community. And I'll just play it for you, those who read Hebrew or understand Yiddish, and then I'll say what he says, and you'll be astounded. But then you won't, this is nothing compared to what I'm going to play you after this. It's all this, there's this guy named Fishoff, who's very interested in this, kids off the derech, and he's trying to create a new approach in the Haredi world. So I went to Rabbi Edelstein. You can get the whole transcript of what he says, but I'll just play you a couple things here.
house, a mensch, what does a bachel bring to a maidel in the house?
Okay, so he's, I'll explain as we go along. He was talking about all the things that Rabbi Edelstein was saying, you can never throw a kid out, even if he's not Shomer Shabbos, doesn't wear a yarmulke, you always have to keep the kids. And he says, our generation is not like previous generations. So then he says, well, let's say your son brings his girlfriend home. Can you imagine what this means in a Haredi house? And I'm talking to sleep over. And so they want their own room in the Haredi or the Hasidic house. Are you allowed to, what should you do? Now, most people would say, well, of course you don't put them in the room together. How could you do that even in a modern Orthodox? But look what Rabbi Edelstein says. Rabbi Edelstein says, no, but they can get them in the room. And he says, well, what about they're in your house, the sin, etc.? Look what he says. Okay, so Rabbi Edelstein says it goes so far as you even give the son and his girlfriend a room in the house. Now, if that isn't gonna, you know, show you that there's been an enormous change, and it's obviously a response to what's going on in the Haredi world. I want to now show you, and this is in English, and we'll end with this, Rabbi Moshe Hillel Hirsch, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka. He actually comes from America. He was from Lakewood. He married into the family. Listen what he says. And all I can say is I'm astounded.
Something happens to them, and then they feel like I'm homeless, I'm an orphan, everybody looks down at me, and I can't breathe. And that's why they do drugs. We say, I understand. You're not from. I respect you 100%. Be not from. You're still my child. We're going shopping. I'm buying you. So this is one of the challenges that I asked of Gershon. If you have a girl and you don't buy her the clothing that she wants, so you're not a parent. So can you buy her not sneezed clothing that she wants? Kidei, that we should be, that she's my daughter, I'm a parent. It's not a problem.
So first he says you could buy unsneistic clothing, but you haven't seen anything yet.
Not at all, problem.
And an iPhone.
Everything is mutter. Anything which can bring her back is mutter. That's the idea.
Okay. It's not lifting either because they can buy it.
No, but they do that. No, that's not yes, either. But here, the either is because they're bringing a mitzvah. But this is not a mitzvah. This is really bringing them back.
Since we're doing it to bring them back,
That's a heter. If you want to bring him back, there's no need for you, man. For catching you're taking away the mechshul.
The medicine is counterintuitive, and that's what throws people off.
Okay. She have a sort of writer.
Amen. Once had that they went to a ball game, and the daughter said, "Can I have money for a Frank?" So. What I was told, I'm curious if she was okay, that he gave her money to buy it wasn't a problem at all. You could buy whatever she wants. Without pikuach nefesh, just in order to make her feel comfortable, is that okay?
If it tachlis is to get her back, probably it's okay. That's the point. The point is that it's all
to create a kesher.
To get her back to Yiddishkeit.
And buying it itself?
I don't see enough for me.
No, for me. It's in other words, anything usher, if it's to create a kesher, which brings them back and makes them comfortable, that all of a sudden becomes.
Yeah, it's not really. It's not a mitzvah. That's a kesher. This is a real.
Okay.
Options.
He says.
I got all this.
Hold on. I hear noise. I got to turn the noise off. Someone has their speaker. He says that, which I find astounding. Not only obviously you can give the poor kid the kid can buy whatever they want, but you can buy the hot dog. So someone sound, Rabbi Kalman, can you turn the sound off of someone? Hold on, I see. It's like, can you imagine? You're at a ball game and you're with your nephew or your son, your daughter. They're not religious anymore, and they want a hot dog, and you go buy the non-kosher hot dog for them. I find that astounding, and I can't imagine other poskim agreeing with that. But it just see how far it's gone, because he's saying that you show the kid that you love the kid, and you're not judging the kid, and you can bring them closer. If a modern Orthodox rabbi would have said that you can buy a non-kosher hot dog for your irreligious kid at a ball game, they would put him in chayrim and say that this is far from orthodoxy. So, but, and it all goes back to the principle we spoke about, that it's not leaf naiver, because you intend, it's intended to bring them closer. So I just find that amazing. Okay, everyone. We are now picking up where we left off. We are in Siman Sadi Zion, page 216. And if you recall, we were dealing with, well, let me first summarize it again, because this letter we're looking at from Rav Shlomo Aviner had a great influence on me, maybe mistakenly. I was writing an article and doing research on the Rambam's approach to superstition, demons, and the like, and I was convinced that there is a passage in the in his commentary in the Mishnah, in Maseches Avodah Zarah, chapter 4, Mishnah Zion, in which he explicitly denies the existence of demons. The problem is that none of the people who wrote about the Rambam cite this passage. Even Rabbi Kafech, the great Rabbi Kafech, doesn't cite this as being a proof that the Rambam denied demons. They cite other passages and things. And I wrote to Rabbi Aviner because Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, despite what seems to be apparent, he wanted to argue that the Rambam really did believe in demons. I said, what about this passage in Avodah Zarah? And he wrote back to me, and this is the first part of the tshuva, that this is not referring to, the language is ambiguous, but he said it's not referring to the existence of demons, it's referring to having a connection to demons, asking them for things, so some involvement with them. That's what he said it refers to. And that's the letter. And based on that, I wrote an article on the Rambam and superstition, and I cited this opinion that Mishnah and Avodah Zarah doesn't, it's not really a denial of the existence of demons. It's only a denial that you can use demons, you can ask them things, etc. No one corrected me at all. No one said a word. All the people, as I said, so Rabbi Kafech doesn't mention this as a site. It's ambiguous what it means, if it means demons per se or demons to use them for a kishuf and things like that. And then I published a book, and no one makes a comment. No one corrects me. Big scholars looked at it, including Gerald Blitzstein, Zichrono Livracha, who just passed away. He wrote a review of the book. Rav Lichtenstein said that Gerald Blitzstein was the Rav's top student. Rav Aaron couldn't say about himself. I think Jerry Blitzstein would say Rav Aaron was the top student. So he's the second top student. No one made a comment. So I thought it was obvious. It was correct. That doesn't mean that Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda and Rav Aviner are correct. The Rambam obviously denies demons. But this passage can't be seen. And in the book, I say the Rambam nowhere explicitly denies demons. And then something happens. A new edition of the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah came out of Mali Adumim, the great yeshiva of Mali Adumim. And translated by this man. Genius of geniuses. He'll be upset if I said that, so don't tell him if any of you know him. I've been corresponding with him for many years. Dror Fixler, he's an award-winning physicist in Israel at Bar Ilan. In the scientific world, they know him for physics. Lo and behold, after all these years of corresponding with him, 3 years ago, or 2.5 years ago, I'm in Beijing. I go Friday night to the Chabad. I sit down. Lo and behold, who's sitting right next to me? Dror Fixler, because he runs this whole program with China. And the Chinese students come to Bar Ilan to study. He goes there. Well, he's also a musmach. He's a rabbi. He's Talmud Muvhak of Rav Nachum Rabinovich. He's the one who's explained many of his views. And he's an Ashkenazi, but he taught himself Arabic. And he has begun to translate, in addition to many, many Torah articles, translate a new works of the Rambam from Arabic. So I'm holding in my hands here from 2002, his commentary on Avodah Zarah retranslated. And based on this and the way he wrote it, I wrote to Fixler just to clarify this matter. And Fixler, who's also an expert in the Arabic, says there's no question at all that Maseches Avodah Zarah, Rambam's commentary, chapter 4, Halacha 7, is a denial of the existence of demons, not just as I was led to believe, demons that's together with Kishuf and Nichush and all these sorts of things. So you can all investigate it further. But for now, I'm going with Professor Rabbi Dr. Fixler that the Rambam does explicitly deny demons in his commentary on in the Mishnah, but I'm not 100% sure. Now, the second part of my letter here to Rav Aviner was I had wrote to Rav Aviner because during the withdrawal from Gaza, we saw some interesting things. It broke down in the right-wing religious Zionist world between what they call the Kav, which Rav Aviner is part of, and the non-Kav. What do you do? That is, do you protest? Do you fight the soldiers who are dragging you away? Or do you kiss the soldiers and say, we understand you have no choice in what you're doing. We're leaving. It's unfortunate, but we're not going to go up against the soldiers. Now, the Kav, who view that group, who view really the army as holy, and the mamachtiyut is holy, the whole thing. They're not like the Merkaz. That's why Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva split. Merkaz HaRav is the mainstream, I guess you would say, or I don't know if it's mainstream. It's the old fashioned main from the Merkaz HaRav perspective. If the government is forcing the uprooting of settlements, then this is not a holy government. This is a government we need to protest, have them drag us out. But they refuse to do that in the other segment. So I wrote to Rav Aviner for some explanation on this, because Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook was very firm in opposing all withdrawals. And he says, he replies to me, and this is really a good understanding of the approach of what they call the Kav, that segment of the right-wing religious Zionist world that the government can really do no wrong in an ultimate sense. You saw, among some of these right-wing religious Zionists, after the expulsion from Gaza with the withdrawal, some of them really were no longer even interested in Zionism. What was important to them, Raftal is one of them, it really was a focus on the land, and that they had really lost all respect for the government as a force, you know, as a representative of the kingship of Israel, Malchus Yisrael. Merkaz didn't go that far, but they had no difficulty speaking very strongly and encouraging protests, etc. But Rav Aviner said as follows, that Rav Tzvi Yehuda taught us that we have to have Mesirut Nefesh, give of ourselves for Eretz Yisrael. And everyone in Israel and every person in the army has to do what he can, or he, she also, to prevent any withdrawal from territories. He also said, and this was my question, that any order to uproot a settlement is an illegal order, but Tela Umuvutelet, that has no effect. So my question was, then why did you, and Rav Aviner went down there and told them, we should all, you know, kiss the soldiers as we leave, but don't protest, etc. Rav Aviner says, in these matters, we need to distinguish between halacha and halacha lamaseh. That is, what's the law, Jewish law, and what's the Jewish law in practice? And he writes that, he gives an example where in one settlement, they set up like this illegal mini settlement. Or see who was there, it's a famous story. And they came and they told him that he has to leave, that they're going to tear it down, tear these tents down. And Ritzvi Yehuda said, I'm not leaving. And even if you want to bring a gun here, I'm not leaving. But then when a higher officer came to him and explained to him that, you know, you really can't stay here, he agreed and he left. The idea being that if it really is going to come to a civil war or fighting or raising a hand against a soldier for the Kav, the army is holy. It's a representative of Mahut Yisrael. And it's to raise a hand to a soldier or policeman to try to withstand what they're doing, even passive resistance, that can't be done. So Rabbi Aviner says that, so Rav Tzvi Yehuda, he left when he was asked. He says, obviously, it's more of a crime to force the people to leave than to agree to leave. But he says, these are the sorts of questions that you have to know the situation. And the basic principle is that no person in Israel can do anything to assist removing of settlements. Nevertheless, halacha l'maaseh, once it's already being done, and the government has made the incorrect, unfortunate decision. I'm saying incorrect, unfortunate from the standpoint of Rav Avinir. Obviously, people on the liberal religious Zionism or Soloveitchik or Lichtenstein, they had a different perspective on this. He says, but once the government has decided to do this mistaken path, then you have to look at each case on its own, just like every other halakha. There's many, the situation changes. But the Ikaron, the principle stands that it's forbidden to remove any settlement, and everyone must do what they can to prevent that. The question is, what happens when the government decides to do the wrong thing? And Rav Avinir's position is that this is the position of the Kav, that we're sad, but we will not stand up and protest against, we can protest in a square, but when the soldiers come, we don't raise our hands to them, we don't resist in any way. And the truth is that Rav Tzvi Yehuda, he wasn't 100% consistent. When it came to the Sinai, and the people went down there to protest about leaving the Sinai, I came shortly after that to BMT, and the Madrichim of BMT were among the people who snuck into Sinai and protested. Rav Tzvi Yehuda said, though, at that time, there's no need to protest because the people are not with us. You can't have a protest if the people are not with you. But he had other times when he said, when it comes to Yudan Shomron, because that's really biblical Israel, the Sinai is not, he said that he did say it'll lead to civil war if they try to give it back. Now, does that mean that there should be civil war? Or is he just speaking rhetorically? That's the issue. And okay, that's number 97. Number 98 is also addressed to Rav Avinir. And here, let me, his answers are just like three words and five words. The question is of interest, though. He has a book. He has many books. It comes out with like 5 a year. It's called Bat Melech. And it deals with women's issues. And it's very conservative with a small c. Even more conservative than you'll find in parts of the Haredi world. A lot of people don't realize this, that the right-wing religious Zionists are in many ways more conservative on women's issues than in the Haredi world. Even in the Haredi world itself, you'll find different opinions. One part of the Haredi world, the more modern part of the Haredi world, makes a big deal about the fact that there's a Hasidic woman judge. And but on the other hand, that goes against the whole Haredi philosophy. But in terms of the rabbis, very conservative, even more conservative perhaps than the Haredi world. And the women they wear these long skirts and they don't wear makeup and they would never dream of wearing a shadel. And the rhetoric is basically the same as the most conservative Haredi circles. So Rav Avinir says on page 226, the majority, the overwhelming majority, Ruam Kakuam, Shel Gadol Yisrael, forbid women's involvement in voting, with the exception of Kama Bodadim, a few exceptions, Shelo Hayu B'Madregat Gadol Yoham, and they're not to be regarded as Gadolim. This goes back to the old dispute when there were elections in Palestine for the Vad HaLeumi, which was the governing authority of Palestine for the Jewish community, and everyone was trying to get their votes in because this would determine how it's run, and the Orthodox, of course, were encouraging it. Rav Kook comes out with a statement, and the Haredi rabbis later also, actually maybe the Haredi rabbis even before, but Rav Kook was the big surprise, that women are forbidden to vote. And when you look back, I mean, it's quaint almost, but the way Rav Kook, he doesn't argue halachically, he argues that almost Victorian sentiments, that a woman is supposed to be at the home, she's the man goes out and struggles outside, and the woman is at home making sure Torah values are in the home, and if the woman, we need to keep the woman from the rough and tumble of the outside world, and lo and behold, if the women get involved in politics and the woman has an opinion on this, and it's different than her husband's, this will lead to the breakdown of Shalom Bayis. You know, the wife is going to vote for Biden and the husband's voting for Trump, or vice versa. It's going to break down Shalom Bayis and all these sorts of, the fact that he doesn't argue halachically is important, because even some of the followers of Cook say that it's not a halachic argument, so it will change with the times. But in those days, this was not long after in America, women got the right to vote. I mean, in Switzerland, there were cantons that waited decades. So it's really a period piece. It, when you read it today, it's strange. Even in a Haredi world, all the women vote today. Everyone votes. What, you're going to give up half your population in terms of voting? But so Rav Avinir is not saying that the women shouldn't vote, but he's talking like in some theoretical world, even a messianic world, that really it would be better if we didn't have voting. And he goes so far as to say that, look, in my synagogue in West Orange, New Jersey, women didn't have the right to vote until in the 1980s. They gave them the right to vote. And I mean, it's very strange, but and I'm sure there's places still today. But Rav Avinir says that only a few rabbis permit it. And he's talking about at the beginning when they had the dispute. Today, as an emergency measure, of course, the women have to vote. And he says they were not gedolim. So I wrote to him, how could you say this? Rav Uziel, first Sephardic chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, of the state of Israel, he was not one of the gedolim? What about Rav David C. Hoffman? What about Rav Yechiel of Weinberg? They have no problem with voting. He has no problem with voting or being elected. Rav Uziel writes, he doesn't understand this. They said it's not snius. Men and women to be mixing at the in parliament. He says they go to the supermarket, they mix. So I said that in my opinion, the way you frame this is pigia b'chavodam, that this is really degrading to these great rabbis. You say that no great rabbis, when they had the discussions of this, said that women should be allowed to vote. Obviously, I'm talking about Gedolim. I could have said Rav Soloveitchik. I could have said any numbers. But these are the ones who wrote about it during the disputes. And what does he write back? And you have to give him credit for this, because a great Talmud Chacham, an authentic Talmud Chacham, is not afraid to acknowledge, and not embarrassed to acknowledge, when they spoke improperly. He writes, Sodek, Yeshar Koch. He says, you are correct. In other words, I misspoke. I shouldn't have used that language. And then I write to him a second thing. In the same book, he writes, well, this is mine was one letter. He's speaking, and you find this often, he speaks about the idea that how Jews punish. And he says, "Ein etzlenu beit sohar." We do not have, Jews do not have prisons. And then that's often used, people use that as an argument that the idea that we send people to jail, it doesn't make sense. Jews never send people to jail. We should follow Jewish approaches. It's true that there is, in Masechet Sanhedrin, they speak about putting someone in a kippah. If you lash him and he still continues to do the crime, or if he commits a murder, let's say, and you can't convict him, but you know he did it, but you can't convict him with the witnesses. The witnesses may be, you have 10 witnesses, but all of them are pasul or something. It says you throw him in a kippah and you feed him certain things, you force feed him, and then that causes his death. That's the way the Chazal were able to keep order through extra legal means. But that's not prison. Prison is we keep people for long term. But what are the options if you don't have prison? What are you supposed to do? They didn't. So in Spain, for instance, maybe if they had prison, they couldn't have done some of the barbaric stuff they did. They chopped off people's hands. They chopped off people's tongues and did all sorts of things that today we regard as torture, because they didn't have prisons. In any event, I write to him and say, I don't understand this argument of him that, arguing against the idea of prison. I say, if the government wants to put a prisoner, a violator in prison, it has authority to do, though the Torah grants him, the rabbis grant authority to that. Also, it has the authority to give malkos, lashes, and even misa. Even the government can put people to death if they want. It might not be a smart thing, might not be a good thing, but the Torah gives them the authority. I said, you should look at Simcha Asaf's book, Ha'onshin Acharecha Timata Talmud. Simcha Asaf, the great Supreme Court Justice, but before he was Supreme Court Justice, he was an Eloi from Telz, a huge Talmud Chacham. He has a whole book showing how courts throughout the generations punished people, because when you have an autonomous community, you have to punish because you have the authority. They had jails. For instance, I already spoke in previous classes how the Shire Ephraim, Ephraim and Cohen from Buda, from Pesht, speaks about you need a mezuzah on the jail. The Jewish community had its own jail. In Prague, they had a jail. We even think that when you go into the Altnoy Shul, people have been with me, I've showed them where they have the little room there with the bars, that could have been the prison where they kept people. They could only put a couple, one or two in at a time. But we know Jewish communities had jails. And I say to him, from your language, it appears that the idea of having a prison, a jail, is against Torah and Chazal, and that's not eno nachon klal. That's not correct at all. There is permission, yesh rashut, for judges in every generation to do what is correct in their mind, l'takenat olam, to fix the world and protect the population. The Rambam speaks about it. The Ran speaks about it. The rabbis, the Beis Din, have the authority. Even if the Torah doesn't speak about a prison, well, they have the authority to develop any system they want, and Jews have, and that's in line with Jewish tradition, that the Beis Din, when it has authority, can do what it wants. So, for instance, in Israel today, if a guy won't give his wife a get, they throw him in jail. And that usually does the trick. Not always. There was one guy who, for decades, didn't do the trick, but that does the trick. Rav Kafach didn't think this was helpful. He thought we should go back to the Rambam. The Rambam says, for these people who don't give their wife a get, the Rambam has a simple solution. You beat him until he gives the get. You can't do that in America, but you can do that in the Jewish state. And then the question is, the Rambam asks the question and he answers it. Well, doesn't the get have to be given willingly? When you beat him, then it's willingly, because he wants to give it. Now, the Rambam says, because really every Jew wants to, deep down, wants to do the right thing. But at the end of the day, you're making him see the light. And what does Rabbi Alvinger say to my strong criticism of him? A criticism that you often hear people all they know is the Gemara and the Chumash. And they know that if there's not two male witnesses who warn someone ahead of time, you can't punish them, which means I can kill everyone. When's the last time a murderer murdered or robbed before two people who gave them a hasarah, a warning ahead of time? You can never enforce any law. You can't, because that's the biblical, like almost theoretical law. If you look at how courts throughout history have done it, the Gemara speaks about how they killed all these witches, Rishim ben Shetach. And they speak about how they killed a guy who was riding a horse on Shabbos. So that's not even a Torah law. How do you kill someone for riding a horse on Shabbos? And they explain, because in order to establish the law, so that there's no breakdown in society, the sages, the Beit Din, can do anything they feel necessary in order to keep order as emergency measures, and not just as emergency measures. The Ran, we spoke, you can go back to my classes on Herzog, where he deals with the view of the Rabbeinu Nissim of Girona, because when they were thinking about creating a constitution, when he was writing a constitution for the future state, how would a future state function? What are you going to do in terms of courts, etc.? So what does Rabbi Avinay reply to me? He says, this was my intention, but I was too short. Shuv pam yesh hakoach. Again, thank you, you are correct. This is important, that the rabbis, great rabbis, much greater than me, are able to acknowledge when they misspoke or they were incorrect. And so even if it's only a few word answer, I give him a lot of credit for that. Now we go to Siman 99, and this is actually the last Siman in the section which is known as Dat Umedina. When people see him here in Hebrew, Datu Medina, religion and state, they think of Israel. But as we saw already, the questions were not just about Israel, they were about America. This word dot, incidentally, let me show you something here. Dot as religion. Where do we get this from here? If you look all the scholars today will tell you that the word dot is a Persian word. It only appears in the later books of the Bible. Except we have it in Devarim, chapter 33, where you have this word that's written as one word, but is read as two, eshtat. And the sages, and you go up at Unkelus also, read this as eshtat, namely a fiery law. If you look at it from an academic perspective, and it's I'm holding in my hand, for instance, an article from the Journal of Biblical Literature by Richard Steiner, in which he talks about this. It's hard to say this is a scientific translation, because we know that dot comes from, it's a Persian word, so it wouldn't be in Devarim. Now, yes, the Chazal understand it that way, but Chazal give lots of derivations. that are not scientific, but are moralistic or hermeneutical, that they even explain to Tiberius. Why is it called Tiberius? They give a reason, a midrashic reason. They give midrashic reasons for Esther's name. Tiberius, it's from the emperor, the Roman emperor. So when Chazal see a word and they explain it, that doesn't mean that that's the scientific etymological meaning. That's their offering a midrashic meaning. If you look in Steiner's article, he wants to claim that it's really dot here is a the aleph has dropped out. It's an irregular spelling of the verb of a verb dalad aleph hey, which means like to fly or to fire flew. That's how he translates it. That from his right hand fire flew unto them. That's how he translates it, and he from the word dalad aleph hey, which means like to fly or to travel or something like that. It's a rare word. But that's Professor Steiner. Professor Steiner, for those who don't know, was many years professor at Yeshiva University, an expert not just in Hebrew, but in ancient Semitic languages. So getting back to what we're doing now, this is the last siman in this section. And it's written by a figure we've seen a number of times. There he is, Rabbi Chaim Rappaport from London. He knew Rabbi Sachs, obviously, quite well. Also, he could talk to you about him. He writes to me in 2012, responding to a blog post I wrote about certain issues with the Haredim in Israel, about a certain Haredim, a Satmar author named Yisrael Harfenis. He's written a number of very good Sfarim, but within the Sfarim, which are good, there's all sorts of nonsensical things. And when I say nonsensical, I just mean like, well, we'll see an example that Rabbi Rappaport gives. Just, some people, they're so blinded by their hatred for the state of Israel that they come up with some of the most outrageous things. So I mentioned a bit of that, and Rabbi Rappaport writes me as follows. And he says, in my blog post, I mentioned shitotav shtuyotav, the positions, the nonsense. He does a malitza, play on words, of Rabbi Harfenis. And he says, I'm going to give you another example of one of his books that show you really how, and he's a Satmar author, that how just really out of it they are. This is what Rabbi Harfenis says in his book. He wrote a book on Hilchos Hanukkah. And he's speaking about the idea that you're supposed to place the menorah outside. Coming up to Hanukkah soon, but in Europe, they didn't place it outside. There was, they're afraid of the non-Jews, and it became the custom, the practice to put it inside. But if you live in Israel, of course, you want to put it outside. They build these things into the walls, and you put it out there. What does Rabbi Harfenis say? However, in our day, in the land of Israel, the practice of many people is to light it outside, which is the simple understanding of the Takana of Chazal. And this was what the Purushim did. The Purushim, the followers, the Vilna Gaon, who went in Aliyah. He says, however, and he says, in our day, in the land of Israel, most of the Hasidim light on the inside of the house, like they used to do in Chutz Laaretz. And then he says, even today in the land of Israel, there's a chashash, there's a worry that the wicked ones of Israel, the Rishei Yisrael, the Mumarim, the secularists, that they're going to turn out, they're going to mess around with your candles, turn out the lights. And then, you know, these people who are found in Israel, and he says, Umasi b'chol yom, sheyehudim haredim sovli metzionim, shem reshaim yerkav. He says, it's every day there's stories that the Haredi Jews in Israel suffer from the Zionists, the wicked Zionists, may the names of the wicked be blotted out, through attacks and redifat hadat, that there's persecution of Judaism in the state of Israel. And they break into synagogues and bate midrash, and they trample on all that's holy. I don't know, I read the news every day. I haven't heard much in the way of that. And then he goes on, that he says that, he quotes from a book that a year after the Medina Hatzionit, that is the Zionist state. They can't call it the state, the Zionist state. When the Chazon Ish went to bake matzahs, he says that it's a year after the state was proclaimed and we can still bake matzah. This is, you know, Chaste Hashem. This is, you know, the mercy of God, because there was a fear. You had many people who were afraid that when the labor rights who were in control, that they would institute restrictions and all sorts of things about require everyone to go to secular schools. None of this came to be. It was all based on these false ideas that that the secular Zionists would insist on indoctrinating everyone. They did some indoctrination with the Yaldei Tehran and the Sephardic kids, but the idea that they would take, let's say, Hasidic children from their homes and put them somewhere in a secular environment, it never happened. And then, so the Chazon Ish was surprised. And then he says, the Satmar Rebbe, Maran Misatmar, said that he's afraid that there will come a time when we're not going to be able to observe Torah and mitzvot in the land of Israel because of the persecution of the Zionists. Okay, so that's now, and Rabbi Harfenis is writing this like in recent years, in the last 10 years. And Rabbi Rapport says as follows. Apparently, these people live in a world of imagination. And what we can see with our eyes, with our chush, they don't see. In other words, it's like the people who just don't believe what's out there. They'll deny that vaccines work, and they'll deny the moon landing and all these things. They don't see, because obviously, if you go to Israel, I don't care how right wing you are, you see that Torah is thriving and it's never been better. And to speak about the secularists bursting into shuls and all this sort of stuff, it's crazy. And then he says, in addition, that there's Ein Shachar, there's no basis for what Rabbi Harfenis says. And it's actually the opposite is correct, that if it wasn't for the monetary award, the monetary help of the Israeli government for the Torah institutions, you wouldn't have the kolos and the yeshivas. The greatest supporter of Torah in history is the Israeli government. The Israeli government gives more every single year than all the donors in America have given to Torah in the last 50 years. It's really unbelievable how much money is given. Now, to their credit, I guess you could say that, yeah, I think to their credit, Satmar, they're anti-Zionist and they won't take money from the government for their yeshivas. So I guess there's some honesty and consistency there. It annoys me to no end when anti-Zionists take the money. But for Satmar to say they don't take any money from the government is not really correct. First of all, they use the police when they need it. They use the roads. They use the health insurance and all these things. But at least they don't take money for the yeshivas. But Rabbi Rapport's point is, you're going to say that the state of Israel is the big enemy and is going to destroy Torah. If it wasn't for the state of Israel, you wouldn't have all these yeshivas. They support them. Including, he says, the kol of the Chazon, the Kol Chazon Ish, they get money from the government. And then it says, he says, a certain wise man once said that we live in an era that legend is history and history is legend. Legend is history, history is legend. So the true history, the true things, that you don't believe, but the legends you believe. Now, one of the people who's on with us right now, he shared the following with me, which I didn't even know of, but this is famous, apparently, from the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. It's almost what Rabbi Rapport was saying. I don't think he knew it, but listen.
Well, you're not going to use the story, Mr. Scott?
No, sir. This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend. He's right, Rams.
So it's the same thing. Rabbi Rappaport pointing out that among these, there's some people who are just so blinded that they didn't know what to do when the Satmar Rebbe's grandson... Well, the two Satmar Rebbe's nephew, I think he's the great-grandson of the previous Satmar Rebbe, joined the Israeli army. And he's not a secularist. He wears a kippah through God. So that's with that, we end the section Dat u'Medina. When we pick up next week, we have all sorts of interesting things. And as I said, a new cast of rabbis for the most part, new issues. The section is called Tikkun Sofrim. We're going to pick up with the idea, although the focus of my letters to Rabbi Kafech, the great Rabbi Kafech, I'll tell you all about him, and Rabbi Yitzhak Shelat, who, if you haven't heard of him, take my word for it. He is someone who they will be reading in 500 years, or at least 200 years. What he achieved is really incredible. And I'll explain to you who he is. And if you haven't heard of him, you'd be quite surprised that you haven't heard of Rav Shelat, because every single scholar of the Rambam and other works has his writings. The question is going to be, but it's going to start just as a translation question, but get into a basic philosophical question. Is there a commandment to believe in God? How can you have a commandment to believe in God? Who's doing the commanding? What do we say about Anochi, the very first commandment? And what does the Rambam mean when the Rambam includes it? So we'll have to get your Arabic ready and our medieval Hebrew translators. And we'll move on. All sorts of interesting things. What does Adon, think about this. What does Adon Olam be? Eternal Lord or Lord of the Universe? All sorts of interesting stuff. If you're interested in Dikduk, if you're interested in Siddur, in translation, and Rav Mazuz. We're going to really get into Rav Mazuz and his thing. So we're starting next class. We'll start at page 223. So we're more than halfway done the book. Let's get to the questions. We covered a lot today. Let us see what some of the learned questions. I learned so much from these questions and comments. So someone mentions privately that a biography of Chaim Ozer just came out. Yes, I actually put my order in for it. That's by Rav David Kamenetsky, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky's son. He's a great, great scholar of the Lithuanian Torah world. He also works for one of the auction houses. That'll be something. Mel says, Yaakov Ish Tam, Yoshev Oli. The question, the word Tam is a... what does it mean though, Mel? Because Tom, we read it on, when we say, Tom could mean a positive thing, or it could mean like a simpleton. When we read it on the Haggadah Shel Pesach, it's not a positive thing. It's sort of like he's a simpleton. And the same thing is the word Tamim. What does Tamim mean? Tamim is, it's used often in a very positive way. Someone is pure, is not affected by the outside world, is holy. And I use that as well when I published an article on the Stipler, which was based on these, my classes, my Torah Moshe classes. It was translated to Hebrew and it appeared in that big thick book, Hagadolim. Let me get you the book. Stay right there. Here's the book, big book. It's called Hagadolim. We had a conference in Israel. It's people who created the face of the Haredi Judaism in Israel. You can see it online, the different talks. So I wrote my paper and I translated to Hebrew. And the title that Benny Brown, the great Benny Brown, gave it was Hatamim, Rav Yisrael Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky Hastaipur. And I agreed with that. It's a good, because Rav Kanievsky was not interested in mechkar and research, very like simple belief, in opposition to philosophical belief. And that's what Tamim means. And Chabad called himself the Tamim. If you study at Chabad yeshivas, you'd be known as the Tamim. But I was criticized. I was attacked by one of the Haredi websites because I insulted the Stipler. I'm calling him a simpleton. So the word, there's like two meanings for the word Tam. David Eisen says he knows at least one other Etam, but it's indeed a rare name. Someone asked me privately, is this Boyarin related to the Hasidic Rebbe in Heilman's book, Who Will Lead Us? No, there's no Hasidic Rebbe named Boyarin in Heilman's book. He speaks about Bion, the Bionner Rebbe. Bion is a Hasidic dynasty. Bionner Rebbe is Breyer. He's the son, actually, of Professor Breyer from Yeshiva University. It's an interesting story. A guy, the Hasidic Rebbe, the Bionner Rebbe, went to Fapush, or MTA, I forget one of the which one, but now he's a Rebbe. But Boyarin is related to someone else, who I won't speak too much about. He has a brilliant, brilliant brother, who's a professor in California, Daniel Bayarin. But Daniel Bayarin, he walks around with a big yarmulke. Talmud Mufak of Shaul Lieberman, a big Talmud Chacham, he's been accused of being an anti-Semite. I'm not going to call him an anti-Semite, but he's about as vicious anti-Israel as you can get. He's pro-BDS. He hates the state of Israel. He's Naturei Karta. When the New York Times did a thing about 5 years ago about Orthodox Jews who hate the state of Israel, he featured, he supports the boycott. So it's a big issue because he's a leading academic scholar and academic conferences and everything. You know, we don't believe in on people's views barring them or anything like that. But it's quite strange to have and when I say an anti-Zionist, I don't mean like a brisker anti-Zionist. I mean someone who fights against the state of Israel, who is when you give the definition of when you say, as we're always told, you know, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Well, it runs into some problems because, or BDS is anti-Semitism because Daniel Bayarin, he had to leave his shul, he said, because it became too uncomfortable. Some guy told him, you know, you should go to the Arabs or something like that. But that, so Jonathan Bayarin's brother is Daniel Bayarin. I have no idea what Jonathan Bayarin's politics are. And look, at the end of the day, Daniel Bayarin has written some interesting things. And I think you got to separate the politics from, he's also written some very radical, progressive type cutting edge type of scholarship that Professor Tversky hated, and I'm not into it at all. Feminist, even hetero, you know, gay type of ways of looking at things, which is not my cup of tea. But he's a big name, Daniel Bayarin, and you try to avoid the politics. Unfortunately, in the academic world, from my perspective at least, you run into lots of people, not as extreme as Bayarin, but centrist, even to find a centrist in the academic world is often hard. Baruch tells us that the earlier name of Chaim Berlin was Tiferes Bachurim. Yes, that's true. Then they changed it to Chaim Berlin. So that he says the MTJ Centennial book, which I don't have, has more info, and that I'll have to look at that. So Baruch says the Haredi Spring, the Lakewood Spring. Someone asked me privately, is the OTD phenomenon in Lakewood primarily male? I'm not in Lakewood, but I think it is. From what I've been told by people, it's mostly male. There's females also. Footsteps is that organization. You have plenty of women as well, but I'm told it's more male. I don't know. Baruch, NCSY wouldn't do that. I don't think NCSY would post. My kids all went on NCSY. They went Machach and everything. They would never post videos of the NCSY kids without yarmulkes or doing things like that. Let me take that back. NCSY has two. They have the public school one and they have the regular one. For the public school one, they're not religious at all. They don't make them wear yarmulkes. But for the religious one, they would never post it. So I guess you could say Minyan Shelanu, these people are not necessarily religious. So it's still a little strange from a Lakewood group that I understand they're not going to make the kids wear yarmulkes or anything like that, but these are videos that they post. But okay, I see it. You want to show if every video there shows them, you know, at the Kumsit Saturday night and shows them with the yarmulkes, then the typical off the derrick kid in Lakewood is not going to step foot into Minyan Shelanu because he doesn't want that. If you watch the videos, these guys came like, I don't know how many months, they came to Night Seder. Like every week they came to Night Seder. So the reward is they're the big trip. The point is that even in Lakewood, the heart of the Torah Judaism, the era Torah of Lakewood, it doesn't work for everyone. And perhaps if they had an option, like a more modern Orthodox option maybe, but it's tough. So you got to give Rabbi Abadi enormous amount of credit. There was another rabbi very involved, Rabbi Gissinger, who passed away recently. I just saw an article coming out with a book about him. Rabbi Gissinger was very involved, it seems, because he gave shiurim and things, talks to this minyan shelanu. I get some shuls probably wouldn't want these kids in it, you know, the way they look. But as Rabbi Rav Gershon Edelstein says, it's a different generation. And I would agree with the Sulzbachs that this is the Kirov movement adapted to the 2020s. these kids come from the Haredi world, 100%. These are all from the Haredi world. These are all from Lakewood type families. No, Baruch, you say this has been around so long, the professor just saw it now. No, I didn't just see it now. I saw the Adelstein thing a long time ago, but I was speaking to someone, and he pointed out the other one, the Rosh Yeshiva Sobotka, Rabbi Hirsch. And since Rabbi Hirsch specifically mentions the idea of Lifnei Iver, the interpretation of Rav Moshe Sternbach, that's why I thought I would mention it. And Rav Gershon Psak was not... No. The question there is if they come to the house and they bring the girlfriend and they're going to go, he's going to go in his room with his girlfriend, you don't throw them out. You let them stay there. That I find astounding. And what not stios means, obviously there's different levels, but you could take the daughter and buy the clothes she wants to buy, even if it's not acceptable in your community. The idea that you would have in a Haredi community, your daughter walking in, still living in your house and walking in and out wearing non-sneous clothing, this is a new phenomenon. This never would have happened 20 years ago that it would be allowed. So I'm told from people in the Haredi world. I don't live in Lakewood, but they tell me. Bischoff gives edited snippets, you say, Taylor to promote his approach. If you ask Haredi Poskim, they might say each question requires a shayla. Could be, okay, I don't know. Regarding my point about women voting, Yellen tells us, the Supreme Court in 1872 held that an Illinois law forbidding women from practicing law was constitutional. The majority opinion stated that God designed the sexes to occupy different spheres of action, and it belonged to men to make, apply, and execute the laws. It was regarded as almost axiomatic truth. Yes, and that's why when you look at Rav Kook, and he's not arguing halachically, I think it's significant. He's arguing from this sentiment that woman and man have different roles. It's the man's place to be out there. Rabbi Yechiyahu of Weinberg has a very different formulation. He was asked this about shuls, like having women be voting and electing, and he said that this has nothing to do with halacha. It has to do with conceptions of modesty. In certain Haredi communities, for a woman to, you know, be involved in the running of a shul, that doesn't work. But in the modern world, that's no issue. And Rabbi Weinberg says, Yagia hazman yavol v'yachria. He says, time will tell. What this means is that each community will work out their own approach. Now, from where we're standing in 2020, the idea that the woman shouldn't have any involvement in the modern world, I'm saying, in the shul and be involved with it, that strikes most people as strange, even though in many Orthodox schools, a woman still can't be president. Rabbi Kelman says, Rav Hirsch Shachter said that the rough and tumble Talmudic debate is not appropriate to women. We spoke about the issue of women as witnesses. It's... The thing is, though, I think the women would say, if you ask the women at Migdal Oz or Lindenbaum, they would say, you're right, perhaps the rough and tumble of Talmudic debate as practiced by men is not appropriate to women. But if the women were learning, maybe they'd have a more feminine approach. Instead of fighting with each other, they're trying to find resolutions and things like that. So it's like when they say that politics is not for women, because there's you know, there's wars and there's all these things. Well, you know, maybe if women were running the world, there wouldn't be so many wars and there wouldn't be so much disputes. I mean, it's you can look at it differently. We do not know how Talmud will be studied when women are involved with it intensively and seriously, because women have never been. So we look at Talmud and Halakha as one approach. When women are involved with it seriously, and this is going to take decades, it could be that there's a completely new way of looking at it, that unless, because we assume men and women are not the same. If men and women were the same, then there wouldn't be a problem with women studying it, even for anyone. The fact that women are different, then why should we assume that we're not going to get new insights, feminist insights, et cetera, et cetera. I have no doubt that that's going to come. What year was it written in? Harfenis was written in, I think it's in the 90s. But no, we know what happened. But there's no difference. You can't compare, Baruch, what happened in the 40s and the 50s. It's right now today in the state of Israel. The government, as I said, is the biggest supporter of Torah. No one can deny that. I'm just trying to look online. If I see, I'll tell you exactly what year. Yeah, Mikdash Yisrael, the book we're speaking about, is 2007. So I can say without any fear of being contradicted, Baruch, that in the year 2007, the state of Israel was very good to the Haredi world. Of course, there's disputes and there's fights and there's issues. But to make it seem as if you're living in the worst times of the Soviet Union, when they're going to shut you down and you can't leave a menorah outside because the Rishayim are going to come around. David says the best explanation he heard from a Hasidic source as to why these days the Hanukkah light should be lit indoors, as opposed to the original decree, is due to the fact that during the era of the Hashmonaim, the enemy of the Jewish people was external, while today the enemy is from within the Jewish people. Okay, they can. All this is justification for doing what was done in Europe. And you can make the argument that today Persumenisa is in the house, and we don't need to change the practice to... But a lot of these things, like why does lots of people won't sleep in the sukkah in Israel, even though there shouldn't be any reason. These things have their own inertia. And finally, Gershon asks, if Gershon can be Gershon, Eitan can be Eitan. Yes, okay, very good. And as we saw already with the Ralbag, even though the name is Levi ben Gershon, in many early sources, he's already referred to as Levi ben Gershon. And we'll have to ask our postgame and the Dayan we have with us, what about a get? If the get is written and it has Gershon, not Gershon, and we can't get a new get, can we keep the get or not? Last thing. Yes, Ellen says, hey, Tamim is not an insult. If Wadol Bavitchers keep giant menorahs year-round at the Chabad houses, I noticed that recently. I just thought it was too complicated to take it down and put it up each year, but I don't know. Listen, I don't want to get into the menorahs here. We have the man who who brought it to the Supreme Court. He's with us right now, who is responsible for Chabad with the menorahs, and it was an important constitutional issue that went before. So far be it from me to even mention a word about Chabad and the menorahs when the great Nat Lewin is with us. But with that, I will, I don't know if he's ever given a talk. I know he spoke for the Chabad not just recently about the anniversary. I think it was the anniversary of this, but I don't know if you've ever, maybe a Torah in Motion talk about the case and the constitutional issues it was raised. Why is a menorah like a Christmas tree, but not like a creche? The Haredim, the way they attacked Chabad for claiming that it's a cultural symbol and trying to remove it from only religion. These are all fascinating. It was part of the B'nai Brak attack against Chabad, but they wanted to put menorahs in the public square and see it as not just religious, but nationalistic, cultural, et cetera, et cetera. But that's for another time, and I leave that to... And Baruch, you know already, I will never say anything negative about Chabad. We're going to see soon the Lubavitcher Rebbe's letter to me. I had yachidus with the Rebbe when no one else could get in after his stroke. I will talk about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So we'll have to agree to disagree on Chabad. So with that, I leave it to you, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, and nothing to leave to me. You know, you're the expert here. I just listen and learn. But okay, well, please God, tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Simi Peters, part 3 on her talk on introduction to Midrash. Those who were there last week, fascinating interpretation on the Midrash of the, okay, that how the structure of the Midrash works. That was really quite a fascinating class. That's tomorrow at 11, followed by 12:15. I mean, each class is independent. You don't have to have come last week to come this week. And then, of course, Benny Gesundheit continuing his 30-part series on Tehillim. That's tomorrow. Wednesday, we have our triple header. Marty Lakshin starting on Rav David Zvi Hoffman, his commentary on the Chumash. And then Lori Novick talking on Tzitzit, ritual, men, women, and ritual, textual analysis. And then night, the Haftarot. And then Thursday night, Rabbi Michael Whitman from Montreal is giving the Parsha Shir. Okay, anyway, we look forward to seeing you all, and have a Laila Tov, everybody be well, and okay, we should hear.